time. He's been organizing this Four Corners seminars for many, many, many years. I really appreciate that he's been job. Also appreciate TI that you know, offering space. So my name is Hye-young and I'm from Toronto, and I'm going to talk about the basically honeycomb materials, but in particular focus on the Haldane tone insulator. Power on this? Okay. Yes, there is. Okay, so I wanted to bring you some candidate materials to start with. So among the some other honeycomb materials, those that is that Michelle there? Okay, I thank you, but you were not there. Okay. All right. you can hear from your others. I said about you. Okay, so the ones that we our group has focused on is mostly a correlated honeycomb materials, and there are not that many examples. So I listed a few of them here. One of them is the iron oxide and ruthenium chloride, and then iridium oxide, and this has been playing quite an important role in condensed matter physics, in particular correlated systems, where we've been looking for exotic bases. And the ruthenium chloride and iridium oxide, these are listed here. Sodium comes with sodium or lithium, as well as layered honeycomb structured ruthenium chloride has been sort of candidate for the so-called heat-type spin liquid. That has been one of big issues recently. And another one that we recently found is the this iron oxide, which is not very widely spread yet, and I'm trying to sell it. That this is indeed a candidate of the Haldane tone insulator that people have been searching for. So today, given the time of the 25 minutes, that I probably don't think have time to discuss any of the heat-type spin liquid, I'll focus on this iron oxide, which is the Haldane tone insulator. And I'm going to tell you what is Haldane. So this work has been done mainly by my former postdoc, Hung Shik, and who has now moved to the Rutgers, and that's our reference. Okay. And before I come here, I checked the registration, the list, and I found the majority of the audience are indeed students. I decided to put more intro slide. So this is basically one of the intro, additional intro that I added almost at the last minute. So if you look at the charged particle in a magnetic field, the classical picture tells us that the they are basically under the Lorentz force. And if you solve this equation of motion, you'll get the whole resistivity is linear in B. Okay, and then 1 over n is here. N is going to tell us the whole coefficient, telling you how many carrier that is inside us. Okay. On the other hand, if you work on the quantum formulation, then it's not a Lorentz force. You put the magnetic field into the vector potential, and that's the full form. And you'll find the energy levels are quantized, which we call Van der Waals. So the if you have a Fermi gas, which will have the this field Fermi levels, which is the Fermi level EF, and once this is under strong magnetic field, then this will forming into this quantized Landau levels, and you can define the so-called filling factor, which is nothing but the total number of electrons divided by the degeneracy of this Landau level, because many of the states collapse into the one of each Landau level. Okay, and later on, it was found that in the case of integer quantum Hall effect, you can see that how this rho xy, which is supposed to be linear in classical limit, is going to be strongly modified due to the quantum effect. And as you increase the magnetic field, which is happening here, B equals zero, this is just a Fermi gas, and forming the Landau levels. And once the B increases, you have, say, the two Landau levels. And if the chemical potential lies between two Landau levels, then you see that the rho xx is going to be zero because there's nothing to carry the charge. On the other hand, there is a finite row xy which is quantized instead of having a linear behavior. So this is going to be equal to, and for a while you are increasing the magnetic field, nothing happens until the Landau levels hit the chemical potential by increasing the degeneracy of the each Landau levels. Okay, so as soon as it hits it, then it will jump here. This process corresponds to this process. And then you will go to the another into the Landau levels where the now filling factor is basically same number of total electron, which is the same number of the degeneracy in the one Landau levels. So at this point, rho xy in quantum, one can calculate, and then it'll come as the 1 over filling factor with h divided by e squared. And then we can also show that because it's gapped here, the sigma xx is zero, basically bulk is an insulator. Then what happens to the sigma xy? Well, because sigma xx is zero and rho xx is zero, rho xy is nothing but an inverse of the sigma xy. So sigma xy is going to be nu, which is a filling factor, times the unit, which is e squared divided by, is about 25 omega. And it's not only finite, it's quantized. That's why we call it quantized Hall effect. And this nu here is a filling factor in this case, in the case of quantum Hall, that you can also connect into the so-called very phase. And that very phase here coming into the gamma here, and that can be also connected to so-called the Schwann number. So this Schwann number in the case of integer quantum Hall effect is nothing but a sum integer, and it's same as the filling factor of the electron under strong magnetic. So the real space picture here is that we know that in the bulk is gapped because these are basically localized in orbits, they are just circulating around, so there's no way you can carry the heat from here to here through the bulk, but on the other hand, along the axis, the electrons are skipping through and carry the hole, carry the electric current, and that gives the finite sigma xy. On the other hand, sigma xx is zero. And you can see this in a fractional quantum Hall, which is the rather involves interaction pictures beyond this simple non-interacting theory. Okay, so that's the simple intro of the quantum Hall effect. And in 1988, Haldane came with an idea that, well, can we have a quantum Hall effect without Landau levels? In other words, I don't want to apply the external magnetic field, but I can still have quantized conductivity. So that's the idea. And then he proposed a very simple tight binding model. You probably can get it from some great. So this is the Hamiltonian that he proposed. It's on a honeycomb lattice, and it has a nearest neighbor hopping, which is between the sigma here is a polymetric that represents two different sublattices because honeycomb has two sublattices, A and B sublattices. And so this term sigma 1 and sigma 2 represent the hopping from A sublattice to the B sublattice, which is nearest neighbor hopping. And then second nearest neighbor hopping, which is represented by T2 here, and there is a T2 here. And note that there is a cosine phi, which comes with identity. So that means A side to the A side, B side to B side, the real part is the same. But on the other hand, imaginary part comes with a sine phi, and that depends on sigma 3. In other words, A side to A side hopping differs from the B side through the different imaginary parts of this hopping. So that's captured by the flux when you have an imaginary time hopping. Imaginary hopping, that means that you have some kind of current going through it, and that can be also represented as a magnetic flux due to the current circulating. And that means that you have two different circulating current or two different flux coming out between the A side to the A side or B side to B side. And this is in fact a spinless fermion because this Hamiltonian carried the C dagger C here, and which doesn't carry any of the spins. So this is without having a spin of half, it is a spinless fermion. And because you have a flux, time reversal symmetry is broken, and then we need a sublattice dependent on the flux. So this was a simple Hamiltonian that he found, the phase diagram, that as you increase the phi, so that's the flux, except the phi is equal to zero, this is a trivial state. So here is a nu is a Schwann number, and m is the sublattice potential. So there is another term here, m is the some constant, which depends on the AB sublattice. So if the A side has more different atoms from the B side, that is possible, it happens. And if the m is not too large compared to the T2, then we are always falling into either turn number minus one, going around one way, and u equal to plus one, which is moving to the other side. And that will be actually anomalous quantum hall. In other words, you will have a hole the quantized sigma xy, but without the external magnetic. It's coming through the internal magnetic field generated by the hopping of the spinless fermions in this case. And in this paper, he sort of said that this particular model presented here is unlikely to be directly physically realized because it is, when you think about it, you need a sublattice dependent flux. Normally, that's rather difficult to achieve. And on the other hand, he sort of motivates us that it may happen if we have some magnetic ordering. But since then, this model has been sort of forgotten. And on the other hand, the other people start catch this model, and instead of having an external sublattice dependent hopping term, they put a Spinovi coupling, and that in fact motivates the new class of topological phases. So that goes into this so-called quantum spin hall. So you can think of the quantum hall is here, like both spin up and spin downs is going to propagate along one direction, in this case, moving in a one direction. So that's the quantum hall. The classical version of this is going to be just the Hall effect. And as we have Spinovi coupling that allow the up spin and down spin move in a counter propagating, which is the, in this case, the blue and red represent two different spins, and moving in two different directions will be a quantum spin hall that resembles the classical spin hall effect, which is coming from the Spinovi coupling, but in a classical version of it. And this one here, they have suggested, is the quantum anomalous hall, where without the magnetic field, there's a magnetic ordering here. So you can imagine that the bulk is again here, all of these bulk are gapped, and the charge is carried through the surface or edge of the 2D system. And this magnetic field, magnetic ordering, you can imagine having a one of the spins now is relevant, something like here. You start with the two of the spins propagating, counter-propagating, and then as you increase the magnetic moment here, magnetic ordering, that will make the one of the spin at the state will collapse and disappear, and you're left with only the other spin component moving in a one way. So these are called quantum anomalous Hall effect, and sometimes called magnetic topological insulator. Some people call it topological magnetic insulator. Some people call it Chern insulator. These are all same thing with a different name. Okay? And proposals are done in 2008 about this after almost 20 years, 20 years after the Haldane, but the physics behind this is, in fact, I don't think they are different. These years are the years that the experimentalists actually observed this. So this one here was done in they proposed the mercury telluride, which is a topological insulator, and doped with a manganese, but they found this in a chromium doped with this bismuth telluride. So that's the experiment. And if you look at this experiment, that this chromium provides magnetic impurities. And because of those magnetic impurities, initially this bismuth telluride is a topological insulator or quantum spin hall insulator, where you had a two propagating, counter propagating up and down spin at this state. And due to the magnetic moment here, one of them disappear, and you're left with only one of the. I think this is running out of battery. Let's see. We have another. So you can see the quantized, this is the resistivity, rho xy, and zero, almost zero rho xx, in a very small range of the gate voltage here. And similarly, this one is now the sigma xx and sigma xy. Sigma xy is quantized within this range of the gate voltage, and then sigma xx is zero. This measurement is telling us that this appears only in a very low temperature, 30 millikelvins, and magnetic moment is generated here is very, very tiny. Okay? So I was thinking, okay, why don't we go back to Haldane model and see why this is, okay, I'll just hit it. How about that? Okay, good. I'll just use this as a point. So so let's go back to the Haldane Toninsula, which is original proposal, where he suggests that this is an example of the quantum wall, and where he suggests that one needs some kind of sublattice dependent term, and then spins the electrons has to effectively spinless. So the two conditions that's needed is first the broken time reversal symmetry, as he proposed that we might need a ferromagnetic, and the bulk has to be an insulator, so it's a ferromagnetic insulator, and that way the spin, one of the spins are fully occupied, and then the other spin is left, and then act like a spinless fermion, because the other spins are just, you know, totally inactive. Another condition is that we do need a second nearest neighbor complex hopping integrals, the real part and imaginary part, and somehow imaginary part has to work for the A sublattice, B sublattice different. And that can happen if you have a proper orbital. So orbital physics is actually quite important in condensed matter, but some of us has been just forgotten about it. So I'm going to propose that there is a one particular compound that, in fact, follow exactly the Haldane tonnage. So this requires the electronic correlation because we do need to have ferromagnetic order, which is coming through the electron-electron correlation. And then we do need some crystal field splitting because we want to get a proper relevant orbital. So we need some orbitals that has to dominate the physics. We also need some sort of the spin-orbit coupling here. So the compound that I'm suggesting is the iron-based ferromagnetic honeycomb oxide. This is actually described by Haldane model. So it has irons. It's called phosphatase because it's surrounded by PO4, but this phosphorus is acting in a rather different environment that I don't think is important. Oxygen is more important. So let me tell you the crystal structure. So this is the paper in a chemistry journal. It's 2012. That's where they first made this material, and it's a barium iron 2 PO4 2. So if you count the chemical the electronic configuration, iron comes as a 2 press, but the barium comes 2 press as well because it's a 2 press. It's a 3d6. Okay, so there are 6 electrons in a d orbitals, and if you look at this, it's a layered structure. These are the iron oxygen is red here, so iron is surrounded by 6 oxygens, which forming an octahedra. And if I look at this one of the layers, which is shown in these pictures, iron irons form just a honeycomb line. And they claim that this is the first oxide to the Ising ferromagnet that has been discovered. So if I look at the phase diagrams, this has the structure transition, which accompanies by the magnetic order. So if you look at the temperature and the one axis is the volume, which is trying to show you the structure transition. And the other one here is a magnetic moment per iron. And the volume has some change. And then also it has R3 structure, R3 meaning that there is a 120 rotational symmetry. It's a paramagnet. And then as I lower the temperature, it goes to the structure transition, which is a P1 bar. So lose the C3 rotational symmetry, 120 rotational symmetry, which often happens because you lower the entropies because it's a lower symmetry than this one. But somehow as the magnetic moment sets in, so this is a magnetic moment at around 70 Kelvin, this sets in and it has a huge magnetic moment. It's a 5 mu B. And as soon as it jumps up, that this crystal become R3 bar. So restore the C3 rotational symmetry. So somehow is that I would think that spin and orbit are coupled through the lattice. Okay, so that's the one important effect that happens. So now before we do any of the calculation that I like to speculate what's happening in this material, and I like to speculate what the relevant orbitals. In fact, that speculation was first proposed in my postdoc, and I actually really appreciate that he come up with this idea. So the when you're looking at atomic levels, let's first think about the atomic levels. And I'm thinking about the energy scales where how about U is the largest, and then Hund's coupling. Iron comes with a very large Hund's coupling. That's why iron's most often is the ferromagnet. And then there's a crystal field splitting, and this is a synovial coupling. Because the 3D samples are not heavy, that synovial coupling is less than the crystal field. Spelling is wrong here. Anyway, so there are six of the electrons on the d orbitals. And due to taking into account U and Hund's coupling, one can see that this one comes with up and then up, and then down, or down with one up. And then if I take into account, so that's after I take into account the Hund's coupling, then all of the down spins will be occupied well below, which is about 3 eV, and I left with 1 eV. So that already tells us I'm already in a spinless fermions where these spins are inactive, and this therefore has like a effectively a spinless. So once we include the cubic crystal field, which is due to this oxygen octahedra, then it's this d orbitals is going to split into t2g and eg, and this one single up electrons will be in one t2g orbital. So now, if you have further, because it has a c3 rotational symmetry, in addition to the cubic crystal field, which means you can squeeze or elongate along the 111 axis, where the 111 is the direction where you can rotate around the 120. So that's 120 rotational axis, and then you can squeeze or elongate, and that gives the trigonal crystal field, which further split T2G into A1G, so-called EG prime. Now EG prime is, you know, sitting in a one of the EG primes, so I have one spinless fermion in two states, so it's a half. Because these are not, there is no spin, so you have to count this as one, two state, and there's one, so it's a half field. Now, if I include the spin orbit coupling, then, and the hoping, and assuming that hoping is rather small, because hoping will generate the band now, and then this is sort of bandwidth, assuming that that's smaller than any of other energy scales here, then the spin orbit coupling here is sort of different from the other systems because this is L dot S, but note that S is already polarized. So in other words, I'm assuming that through the U here, there is an exchange process that makes the S is going to be ordered. So it's a ferromagnet. SC is ordered. We'll try to order the LZ as well. So this EZ prime, which is a combination of LZ plus one, LZ minus one, effectively, because in fact, this is a d orbital. So you're supposed to have angular momentum too. But because of this cubic crystal, it acts like effectively angular momentum one. So then we will, in fact, have only one of those occupied. Okay? And then you split these two. And that's actually quite important. So let's see if this is, in fact, the truth. So in other words, if the Hopping integral is small, then atomic EZ basis is a good starting point. And this will describe the what happens in this compound. I don't know. So large U, this is what we got. That's a band structure that we have obtained. And you can see that this down spins here, and then EG downs are all below here, below about 2 eV here. And then this is going to be all up spins. So effectively, acts like a spinless. And all the other A1Z, EG plus, all here. And then it only have EG minus. And then this band, we calculate the turn number, carries the plus one and minus one turn number. So it does have nice turn numbers, and it's a topological band. It's called turn band. Now, let's see what physics give us such a finite turn number. So that turn number is coming from the hopping through this particular orbital. So tight binding model for the atomic orbital EZ minus prime needs some analysis because it's great to understand where this flux is coming from. Okay? So if you look at the EZ minus or EZ prime, one of the L equals minus one, they are linear combination of this T2G orbitals comes with a complex phase factors, and these complex phase factors give you plus one and minus I theta. Theta is a 2π/3 here. And so that's basically base that orbital, okay? And if I work it out, mapping just directly blindly onto this T1 and T2, we do find that T2, and this is complex. In other words, nearest neighbor is a T1 here. Second nearest neighbor will come of the real and imaginary. So that's already telling us that it seems like a pictures, the Haldane pictures. And the way that we understand this is like why this comes with two different flux, the sublattice dependent flux is because of the inversion center in this bond. So let me try to elaborate quickly because I don't have much time. So this is an inversion center, the yellow part here that maps from this position to that position. In other words, A sublattice maps to B, or this A sublattice maps to the B here, A sublattice maps to B sub. So through this inversion, when I have a minus size zeta phase here, this is a plus size zeta, and the inversion will give us a minus size zeta and plus size zeta. So when you're looking at the imaginary hopping, then you look at this wave package or this wave loaf, wave function loaf, and try to connect them, and you will see that if I hop from B to the B, from the left to the right, I have to connect from plus I zeta to minus I zeta, and which will give me E to the 2i. On the other hand, this map here, going from the A sublattice to A sublattice, the positive E to the I zeta is going to be right to the left. If I'm moving from the same direction, I have to get the E to the minus 2i zeta here. So because of the symmetry of the lattice, and just because of this orbital form, if I write this in the basis of the EG minus orbital, which are the composition of those, it'll come out this, where the C is nothing but carrying the EG orbitals now, that it carry the E to the I zeta for the A sublattice, minus 2i zeta to the B sublattice, and exactly what the Haldane's model has been set it up. So that's what we have. Now, unfortunately, what you are seeing here is that we have two copies of Haldane tumbend. In other words, I have plus one here, minus one. If the chemical potential, because the chemical potential lies here, there is no edge state because these two sum is going to be zero, so I'm not going to get any edge state. So in other words, in fact, what one has to do is bring down the chemical potential from here to here by doing some gate doping. So I talked to one of the experimentalists, and it is possible that can be done. Once we do that, then of course this is a C equal minus one, and this is a plus one and minus one. There will be a surface state through it. Another way to go is that change the barium 2 plus into the potassium or lanthanum plus or 3 plus. So either electron doped or hole doped. It's basically gate chemical doping rather than gate doping. So if you change those one into the lanthanum or potassium, we do find that that chemical potential lies in between the plus one and minus sum band, and there is obviously a state that appears due to this consequence of the bulk and surface correspondence, and that's I have just. Okay, there are other terms; they are very small, so you can ignore them. That doesn't change the physics. Okay, so the conclusion that I want to say is that this barium iron oxide is actually two copies of tumbend when U is large. I didn't have chance to talk about any of this small U limit, and there is an interesting, in fact, topological phase transition, but I think that that's too much this 30-minute talk. So in any case, that's the bring home message, is that this is indeed tumbend with the two copies. So if you change the chemical potential by either gate doping or chemical doping, we'll get into the tun insulator for the first time, so therefore, this will be the first realization of Haldane tun insulator in stoichiometric materials with very large moment and higher Tc, which is about 70 Kelvin, because people have an interest in bringing the large moment and raising up the temperature for the application. So I'll stop here and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. So questions, comments? Yes.
In terms of the kind of Haldane figure of eight phase diagram you showed, mm-hmm. in this material, how what kind of flux value do you have? Like how kind of where are you exactly in that phase diagram? Do you think?
You mean the Haldane phase diagram here? This one here?
Yeah. So what would be like the effective flux in the material?
In actual material.
Yeah. Is it close to pi over 2 or close to 0?
No, the tone number is 1.
But the are you close, say, to the, phi equals 0?
You mean the e to the 2i zeta?
Yeah, the theta, yeah.
So The model that I show you is that theta is 2 pi by 3, so it's a 4 pi by 3, which is same.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's the, if I work on the, forget about all the rest, that's an ideal limit. But in reality, of course, you do have other A1z, you know, there are mixtures, a little bit of other orbitals, so it deviates slightly from there, but it is a 2 pi.
Okay, so it's very, okay, so you're kind of in the middle of this.
Yes,
okay,
yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Further questions, comments? Yes.
So have you calculated the surface band structure?
Yeah, so the way that we do it is that first we have to, there are two ways to do it. One way is that from an ab initio calculation, we have to get the one-year function. So extract the information of one-year functions and the build the one-year function slab geometry. So in other words, you build up the finite samples and then kind of, you know, you have periodicity in one direction, but open up the boundary along the other. Another way of doing is that if one has a tight binding model, then it's rather straightforward. Because you make open boundary for the one direction and the other is a periodic in a tight binding model. And so we do both.
And other questions? I was going to ask. So the argument that you're making is a two-dimensional argument, and actually, three-dimensional ferromagnets are very rare, as you know. If you like stacked two-dimensional antiferromagnetically stacked two-dimensional ferromagnets are common. Or more common, and so if you had a ferromagnetic layer, but then they were stacked antiferromagnetically on top of each other, would that is that a deal breaker for your argument, or could you still use the two-dimensional net magnetization?
Yeah, so this compound is actually very rare in that sense. In fact, it's a ferromagnetic layers.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So that's why your moment is very large. And if you calculate all layers, some number is 3 because they all add up. Once you have a 2 antiferromagnet, I think that will have, that will actually kill it because your some number is 1 and the minus 1. Say that I even have 1 cup. So you put the potential.
Yeah.
But the C equal to 1 and minus 1 is the is not the absolute sign is not important, it's the relative sign is important, and that depends on the direction of the magnetic moment. Mm-hmm. So if the magnetic moments are alternating, it'll have 1 and minus 1, it'll cancel it out.
Right. And three-dimensional coupling in the real material, at what point does that also destroy the argument?
No, this one doesn't. At least this material doesn't.
So it's very two-dimensional.
Yes, and also even you have stacked them, they all add up. So you have 3 more at the state than the 2D layer.
See, yeah. Okay, thank you.